This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to GEICO.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Healing after Election Day. I'm Gordon Deal. Here's what's coming up during this program. There are deep wounds and resulting scars from this election cycle. What happens after we choose our new president? Also, with Halloween upon us and parties this weekend, what does your costume say about you? A psychologist weighs in. Plus, think the Cubs are cursed? Hear perhaps the worst curse in all of baseball. And Flyers, who've had enough of safety videos that try to be clever or funny.
And I think what we're seeing now, 3, 4, 5 years into this trend, is that people who fly frequently say, yeah, that was cute maybe the first 5 times, but after 20 or 30 or 50 or 60 times, it's really kind of irritating.
Wall Street Journal airline writer Scott McCartney on wacky safety videos on flights. He's here in about 20 minutes. Well, this year marks the 35th anniversary of the first reported cases of HIV and AIDS in America. The implications of an HIV diagnosis have improved drastically since the epidemic first began. Now, with early detection and proper treatment, HIV can be a long-term, manageable chronic disease for many. But a number of areas remain unaddressed. We're joined now by Kelsey Louie, Chief Executive Officer of Gay Men's Health Crisis. Kelsey, where are we today?
Over the past 35 years, the outlook for HIV has certainly changed. While we have made a lot of progress, because of the progress we've made with medication, an HIV diagnosis is no longer a death sentence. However, there are still 50,000 new HIV infections across the country each year, with more than 1.2 million people living with HIV across the country. So there's still a lot of work to be done.
All right. Why 50,000, Kelsey? Why is that number that high? I mean, maybe it's better than, I don't know, 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah, well, you know, it's actually remained stable over the past several years. And what has happened is while there has been improvements in some parts of the population, there are other parts of the population that the numbers have been not so good. For example, young men of color who are gay or bisexual, ages 13 to 24, HIV infection rates are increasing with that population. The same goes for transgender women of color. And that speaks to some of the things that we need to do with regards to eliminating stigma and making sure that we are educating our young folks in particular about HIV and AIDS.
Where does this education have to come from? Because I feel like there's been a pretty big awareness campaign for at least a couple of decades now, right?
Yeah, you know, there has been. But this education needs to, I think it's important to discuss where it comes from and how it's delivered. So where it comes from, it needs to come from places where people will listen. It needs to come from not only healthcare providers, which means that we need to improve access to healthcare. It needs to come from family members. It needs to come from schools, perhaps, and how it's delivered. It needs to be delivered in a way that people can hear it. For example, using social media. That's going to be an important tool that we have in terms of educating people about HIV and AIDS. And there are other ways. I think one of the things that this report does is speaks to the fact that we need to have an individualized plan for each group.
I'm gonna sound like a simpleton, so alter my message here, right? But it was, at least back in the day, no unprotected sex, no sharing of needles, and then there were kind of minuscule risks of blood transfusion problems, right?
Yeah. So the updated information is that we encourage everyone to practice safer sex methods based on their individual needs. We still promote the use of condoms. We also know that there are new HIV prevention tools, such as, there is a medication that you can take once a day that has been proven to be effective in preventing HIV infection.
We're speaking with Kelsey Louie, the CEO of Gay Men's Health Crisis. It's the 35th anniversary of the first reported cases of HIV/AIDS in America. and we're discussing this initiative called HIV The Long View. So more about the initiative of one of you two guys in terms of what's happening with it, where it's being promoted.
Sure. HIV The Long View is a public health report that takes into account the future trends of healthcare and tells us what we need to do today with regard to HIV prevention and care. And it came about because we're looking to shift the conversation around HIV and AIDS to include the fact that people are, in fact, living longer. And we found some healthcare trends, such as the need for improved access to healthcare, the idea that people understand that prevention is going to play a key role in addressing our healthcare needs, and the fact that chronic diseases are prevalent, especially as people age. And so these are some of the findings that we learned about, and we've learned how that's going to impact what we need to do with HIV and AIDS.
Thanks, Kelsey. Kelsey Louie, Chief Executive Officer of Gay Men's Health Crisis, for that report, HIVTheLongView.com. 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Everyone knows that business is all about numbers. Consider the numbers the state of Michigan can offer your business, like Michigan being one of America's top 10 states for business. Or 2000, the number of burdensome regulations Michigan has eliminated in the last 5 years. And 6, Michigan's rank for best entrepreneurial climates, which all adds up to the one state that has all that and more, Michigan. Go to MichiganBusiness.org to learn more. As participation in weekend 5Ks and marathons slows after years of growth, one group is gaining. More African Americans than ever are taking up running. Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman has the story. Rachel, what are we seeing here?
Counter to historical trends, the body of distance runners is really becoming more diverse. For decades, it's really been largely white, and when it started out, it was really overwhelmingly male. It's become more female over time, and in recent years especially, African Americans have really adopted running as a social activity and strategy to improve their health.
Interesting. All right. So I guess what has taken so long? Because we know them, obviously, as successful in track and field, and the Kenyans obviously winning the marathons. But
right.
Those middle distances seem to not be, popular.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it helps to remember that, you know, sort of recreational distance running in this country is relatively new. It's only about 4 or 5 decades old that people have been, you know, running marathons and 5Ks and things like that. And in that span of time, there, you know, from the earliest days, there really were not a lot of black role models, especially locally, as opposed to, say, football and basketball and other sports like that, that had a lot of African-American stars and, you know, sort of people who were playing, you know, pickup games and so on that were very visible. But in recent years, what's changing is that there are a lot of really grassroots and some kind of more professional social groups for black runners. And that really has driven the growth. Groups like Black Girls Run, which is based in Atlanta, Black Men Run, both of those groups actually have chapters all over the country now and even a few overseas. And there's dozens of other groups that are smaller that's spotted on Facebook or in individual cities that are really signaling to black runners that if they come out to run, they'll have other people to run with.
Mm. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman. She had an interesting story entitled Black Runners Are Changing the Face of the Sport. So anybody making predictions for, say, I don't know, the months or years to come, is this something that'll stick?
Well, I actually spoke with the executive director of the National Black Marathoners Association, and he says that just like the recent running boom of the last 15 years or so was led by women, he thinks the next one, if there is another running boom, will be led by ethnic minorities, really, who are really underrepresented in running groups, in distance running generally, and they're generally underrepresented in distance running. And so, that's a prediction. We'll see if it happens. Certainly the growth of black runners is speeding up. And there's been, it's about quintupled in the last 5 years in terms of the share of regular frequent runners who are African American. So that certainly suggests that the growth is going to continue.
I thought it was interesting that the one woman you spoke to said that she was motivated by the number of participation medals, like on a colleague's office wall or something like that. So you're saying,
yeah,
you only have to finish?
And I should say, generally speaking, people don't get medals until they run, you know, generally the longer distances where you get the medals. And they're finishers' medals, I should say that. They're not necessarily participation. You really do have to cross the finish line to get those medals.
Okay.
So typically medals are awarded for, like, you know, a 10-mile race, a half marathon, or a marathon. So it really is an achievement just to finish those distances. I'm not aware of many races at shorter distances that give medals, but that is a big motivator for people, believe it or not. You know, it's kind of exciting to not only finish that kind of distance, but to have something tangible to show for it that a lot of people really associate with the Olympics, a medal around your neck. So that is kind of a motivating factor, at least in the beginning, to get people going.
Yeah, it was funny, too. Was the one guy who said, I was hurting so bad and promised he'd never do it again, and he signed up for another one, right?
It's true, and that's very common. I recognize that myself as a runner. You know, it can be painful at times, especially toward the end of a long race, but it is an amazing feeling to finish and also just to be out with so many other people who are going through the same thing.
Yeah.
It's really inspiring, and I think a lot of people are discovering that for the first time now.
So I know the article focused on African Americans, and you sort of alluded to other minority groups. I don't know, are we seeing anything from, say, Hispanics or any others?
Yeah, actually, Hispanics are actually a larger, or not larger, but you know, are approaching the share of African American runners in distance. I think about 6% of frequent distance runners are Hispanic. That has not grown nearly as quickly as the share of Black runners, but that's certainly, you know, the Hispanics certainly are open to growth. I mean, they're underrepresented in distance running as well, and so I think you know, if there were or are forming, you know, groups that can really galvanize Hispanics as well, I think that might spur kind of some of the same growth that we've seen from Black runners.
Thanks, Rachel. Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman, who's based in New York. It is 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Airlines have turned the 3-minute safety briefing by flight attendants into big budget extravaganzas. There are now slickly produced videos which often use humor, but to some travelers, enough is enough. Here's Wall Street Journal airline writer Scott McCartney in Dallas. Scott, what do we have here?
You know, airlines have kind of gone crazy with the entertaining safety video. And a lot of it is branding. A lot of it is reputation. A lot of it is getting hits on YouTube. Ostensibly, the reason they're doing this is to get people to pay more attention to the safety video. And I think what we're seeing now, 3, 4, 5 years into this trend, is that people who fly frequently say, yeah, that was cute maybe the first 5 times, but after 20 or 30 or 50 or 60 times, it's really kind of irritating, and so they're tuning out. There's also been more research on the effectiveness of entertaining, of humor, of celebrities on these kinds of things, and the problem is people remember the jokes, but they don't always remember the safety instructions. So it can be counterproductive.
Like an overly clever commercial. You remember the punchline, but not the product, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a lot of the same kind of research into that. You may remember the celebrity. You may remember the swimsuit models. You know, do you remember how to put on the life vest? Probably not.
Yeah. So who's got a reputation, say, for these safety videos?
Well, I think the leader internationally is Air New Zealand. They started out about 5 years ago with a body paint safety video, which was crew members with body paint on and nothing else doing the safety video, and that got a lot of attention and you know, sort of led them to go further and further and further. They had one out this year, so they did one with Sports Illustrated swimsuit models. They did one with the all-black rugby team, which is so popular in New Zealand, and that one was very popular. They did one this summer with surfers, and And that one actually got criticized by regulators in New Zealand. They allowed it, but said that they thought that the message was too over the top and too distracting. And they've replaced that with a Hollywood themed one filmed on the Warner Brothers set with Anna Faris and scenes from all kinds of different movies. And it's you know, it's a 5 or 6 minute big production.
Wow.
But it, you know, it's interesting. So they do their thing. I think Delta was sort of the first among U.S. airlines, and Delta thinks it's been copied by a lot of others. One of their famous things was a flight attendant wagging her finger for no smoking, and she became known as Delta Lena, and became a bit of an internet sensation herself. Virgin America has for 4 years now, I think, had a very elaborate song and dance number. There's an 11-year-old kid rapping in it that a lot of frequent flyers just say, you know, by the time they get to the kid doing the rap of halfway through, I just tune it out.
Wow.
But United's done it, and then this summer, American came in with a very complex, very intricate sort of great soundtrack based on airport and airplane sounds and people walking all over and stuff, the set moving and pieces everywhere. And somebody pointed out if they were wearing fleece, it would look like an Old Navy commercial. So there's a lot of frequent traveler pushback on these things now.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal airline writer Scott McCartney. His piece is called Passengers to Airlines, Enough with the Wacky Safety Videos. This is no small investment either, right? Say some of these airlines pay up to like $1 million to do this?
Yeah, or more. They are quite elaborate. They're done on Hollywood sound stages with music video directors, advertising directors, big name production people. There's a lot of investment in this. For an airline, it can, I think they feel like they have to do it to be kind of young and hip and appealing to new generation of flyers. I think they do it because they want to have good presence on social media, and you just don't want to be the old stodgy guy sitting there doing the same old thing.
Thanks, Scott. Wall Street Journal airline writer Scott McCartney. It's 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Mailing your letters and packages has just gotten a lot easier thanks to Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can mail and ship anything, anywhere, using just your computer and printer. No more trips to the post office. Anyone can do it. Just click, print, and mail. With Stamps.com, you buy and print official U.S. postage right from your desk. Stamps.com will do all the work for you. They'll even give you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail. And setup is easy, too. In minutes, you'll be printing your very own postage. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my last name, Deal, for this special offer. A 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer that includes postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com. Then before you do anything else, click on the microphone. It's at the top of the homepage and type in the promo code DEAL. That's Stamps.com. Then enter the promo code DEAL. Well, every presidential contest leaves scars, especially as the margin of victory has become ever thinner in recent years. The 2000 election, after all, took weeks to decide. Still, USA Today says the wounds seem deeper this year. How can a healing begin? Owen Ullman is editor of the World section at USA Today. Owen, set this up.
Well, as I don't have to tell you or your listeners, this particular election has been very bitterly contested and has people on both sides very angry, disturbed, divided as a country. We thought we would try to look for lessons around the world. How does a nation come back together after such a divisive election? So we looked at six other countries that had very divisive elections and interviewed a political participant or a scholar in each of them to get some advice on either lessons on how they came together
or reasons why they never did to help Americans come together, hopefully, after this election.
Do you get the sense that, say, November 9th, the day after, or 10th, it will be difficult to heal in the U.S.? Because in the past elections, it just seems like, okay, you know what, this is our president. They won fair and square, and now we move forward.
You're right. In the past, that's always been the American tradition, but there are a few things this time that make us concerned that that may not happen. One of them is that both of these candidates, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, are very unpopular with the other side. They are the most unpopular candidates ever running for president in modern times. So there's a lot of animosity toward them on both sides. Secondly, Trump has indicated that he might not be willing to accept the results of the election. Now, that could change, but he certainly raised the prospect of real division or contesting the legitimacy of the election. Keep in mind, in 2000, we had an extraordinarily close election. It wasn't decided until the Supreme Court many weeks later. But everyone accepted the outcome, and we moved on. The concern is whether that will happen here. And there's a lot of nervousness about that.
Yeah. All right. We're speaking with Owen Ullman. He's the editor of the World section at USA Today. They've got a piece called Red Blood, Blue Blood, How Do We Begin to Heal After Clinton Versus Trump? And the reporters kind of sought advice from other countries that have been through divisive campaigns and elections. All right, so what'd you find when you reached out to the United Kingdom about their divisiveness and healing?
Right. So they had, as you know, a very, very difficult election over a referendum whether they should leave the European Union. And that occurred in June. It was a very close vote, 52% favored leaving against 48%. It forced the then Prime Minister David Cameron to resign from office, and there was a lot of anger on both sides. Those who wanted to leave were concerned about the economy, were concerned about immigration, felt that the European Union was pushing around Britain and they're losing sovereignty. And those who wanted to stay felt very strongly that this would hurt the future of the United Kingdom's economy. And yet, what we learned was that there's a recognition that the vote passed, it was legitimate, and even the current prime minister, who supported staying in the European Union, that's Theresa May, is now committed to leaving the European Union in an orderly fashion. And the advice we got is basically get over it, accept the results, and move together as one nation, because it's in the benefit to move together rather than to remain divided.
That's got to take some leadership from the top, I would imagine.
Absolutely, and it requires, in this case of our election, the winner to be magnanimous and to reach out to the losers and not to suggest a huge mandate, but to find some way to reach out to heal the country by finding areas of agreement. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be a real challenge for whoever wins this time.
Thanks, Owen. Owen Ullman, editor of the World section at USA Today. 20 minutes in front of the hour on This Weekend. Our relationship to money changes as we get older. So do the mistakes that we make with it. Every new stage of life brings new financial strategies we need to follow. And at every stage, we find new ways not to follow those strategies, costing ourselves money and jeopardizing our security. Which ones are you guilty of? It's a story from Wall Street Journal reporter Charlie Wells in London. Charlie, explain.
So, you know, the story sort of moves through the different decades of our life with some sort of new insights for people within that stage of their life. And one of the things that was really fascinating about the 20s was that 20-somethings, who are largely millennials, seem to be playing it a little bit too safe. This current crop of young people seem to have been scarred by a number of financial events, say post 9/11, post the financial crisis, and are now a little bit too tepid getting into the stock market.
Wow. All right. So, I mean, the advice to them is what? Loosen up a little bit?
loosen up a little bit. You know, the consensus essentially is that when you're in your 20s, you have room to make, to take risks, essentially. That there's this group of students that one researcher I spoke with studied, and they were actually choosing retirement plans that would be better for people who were right on the verge of retirement, as opposed to in their 20s when, say, they could, look for investments that might bring higher returns with a little bit of risk, but they've got time to sort of overcome these. Again, don't go out and, say, make the craziest investment that you can imagine, but right. Some stocks in your portfolio are an okay thing, say most advisors.
All right. So what about by the time we hit our 30s?
Yeah, so the 30s are a very busy decade increasingly. So this is sort of a time when people often say, I'm a, quote, real adult. That's a good thing and also a bad thing. So one financial advisor I spoke with said that people in their 30s, they start to finally feel like they've arrived at adult lives, and they want to have the same quality of life as their parents had when they left home. The problem here is a lot of people forget that it took their parents a long time to say, get that 5-bedroom home in that nice neighborhood with those 2 cars and say, that swimming pool. That is, yeah, sort of difficult for someone that might be in their 30s to achieve. And so they might be living beyond their means. They might be spending too much. They might be even taking on a little bit too much debt. That's an issue that you really want to avoid. Another thing in the 30s, people, sometimes this is a good thing, start making more money. Say that there are finally 2 incomes coming in as opposed to just one. There may be children, there may be homes. These are tax deductions that can be made that a lot of people in this very busy time in their lives forget about.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Charlie Wells. His piece is called The Biggest Money Mistakes We Make Decade by Decade. Take us to our 40s, Charlie.
We're in the 40s. That is a time when we're about halfway through our working lives. And yet at this point, things have sort of matured and some bigger expenses enter the picture. So maybe we've got children who are, maybe still running around and we've got to pay for their, say, school expenses. And say they're perhaps getting older and we've got to pay for their college expenses. Yet at the same time, increasingly, our parents are getting older, requiring more care as they live much longer lives. And so there's this idea of the, quote, sandwich generation. And that idea has been around for a while. But what researchers are starting to see is that this is actually happening earlier. We generally thought that it was sort of happening in the 50s. It's actually starting to happen at this point in the 40s.
Oh, wow.
And the solution here really is to be strategic, to have sort of a business relationship with your children and with your parents, and try not to deplete your retirement savings at this point.
All right. Thanks, Charlie. Wall Street Journal reporter Charlie Wells from London. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend.
In business, risks and rewards come with every decision, like moving to the cloud with Office 365. While its benefits include anywhere access and lower costs, cyber threats and user errors can quickly wipe out data and the money you save. Barracuda Essentials for Office 365 provide an added layer of security and functionality for threat protection, email migration, data recovery, and quality of service. Move securely to Office 365. Visit barracuda.com/essentials to learn more.
If you'll be attending a Halloween party this weekend, or perhaps just wearing a costume as you take the kids trick-or-treating, here's some food for thought as you observe costumes. What does your costume say about you? We're joined now by psychologist and psychoanalyst Dr. Frieda Birnbaum, who's based in New Jersey. Doctor, what should we know?
Well, Halloween should be a time for fun, of course, and it should be a time when the children are celebrating, but then again, we have to think about the candy that's wrapped or not wrapped. We have to think about the costumes, what clowns mean today. It's something that's interesting that even my son said, this clown seems scary. It didn't seem so years before. I think there was something in the news the other day that a clown was running after somebody, which was not a good thing. So Halloween represents many different concepts and feelings of celebration and often fear that's contrived by the media, and a fear of excitement from the kids, and a real fear. You have to know when to be cautious and when not.
Right. All right, since you mentioned the clowns, what does it say about somebody who's going to wear a clown costume this year, given all the news that's been made lately?
Well, obviously, to me, that it would be better to keep away from that, because what the fear of clowns represents today, with the unknown, with people having to worry about what's underneath that costume, and what your intentions are. So people think that clowns, I can't even say this, clowns are creepy,
yeah.
That they don't see clowns the way they used to be, and they also have these faces that are not necessarily friendly.
Right, right.
You know, so it's not something that can be looked at lightly today.
Mm. We're speaking with Dr. Frieda Birnbaum. She's a psychologist, and we're talking about what your Halloween costume reveals about you. What about the person who goes as somebody scary, gross?
Well, the gross or scary costume is something that people will hide behind. Now, if there is something going on in the news that's scary, that's part of what's going on in society, that's different. But if you're picking something that is not relevant to what's going on at the time, it's another way of having to lash out back at society in a way that they feel that's less threatening for them, that they can cover up and no one will know who they are.
Thanks, Doctor. Dr. Frieda Birnbaum, psychologist and psychoanalyst. It's 6 minutes now in front of the hour. Sports curses are real, right? You can't admit it, but you know it. Red Sox had the curse of the Bambino. Cubs have seemed cursed, but there's a chance to break it in this World Series. That said, great story by TheRinger.com by Claire McNear, who says her favorite baseball curse is from Japan, the curse of the Colonel. The story goes that in 1985, fans celebrating the Hanshin Tigers' first ever Japan Championship Series victory rampaged over to a local KFC, seized the life-size Colonel Sanders statue standing vanguard outside it, and chucked him into a nearby canal. Then for the next 18 seasons, the Tigers were miserable, finishing last or next to last in the standings each of those seasons. But in 2009, the Colonel was found by divers. The reassembled statue was brought to a prayer service at a shrine near the Tiger Stadium. But here's the worst part. At the conclusion of the prayer service, the chief priest, obviously not much of a sports guy, had to announce these words: "The curse is completely broken." Yeah, well, 7 years later, and the Hanshin Tigers are still without another championship. That'll do it for this hour. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.